the Haftarah for Parshas Vayigash is from the Sefer of Yechezkel, and it's a nevuah, which, in a sense, you can tell how it connects to the Parsha, because the theme of the nevuah is that Yechezkel is told to take two sticks, two staffs, and on one of them, you should write, this is Parak Lamed Zayin of Yechezkel. Just we can look at the first pasuk here together, that God speaks to Yechezkel and says, V'ata ben Adam kach lecha eitz echad, v'chsov alav lihuda, v'livnei Yisrael chavirav, v'lekach eitz echad, v'chsov alav liyosef eitz Ephraim, v'chol beis Yisrael chavirav. You should take two sticks. One stick gets named Yehuda, and one stick gets named Yosef. Ready, two familiar names from the parsha. The two names that are at odds at the beginning of the parsha, a very dramatic opening aliyah. And then ultimately they reunite and they reconcile. So the next part of the nevuah, the next pasuk, v'karvo samechad al achad, v'cha l'eitz achad, v'hayu l'achadim b'yodecha. So you'll take these two sticks together and they'll become one stick. So the symbolism here is pretty clear, is pretty blatant, but the rest of the Haftorah we'll discuss in a little more detail, kind of reiterates it and makes it stronger. But essentially we see what's going on here. This is a nevuah about Yehuda and Yosef reuniting, about the two meluchos coming back together again. And while it was an issue at that point, it's an issue throughout the history, going all the way back really to the whole family structure of Yaakov's marriage already, to Rachel and to Leah. So there's already a rivalry at the very start, and then a rivalry between the children, among the brothers, and a rivalry that continues throughout the generations, and that ultimately there needs to be a reunification. And that reunification comes through some type of tikkun, some type of repair, which is going to be both symbolic and actual, and is going to require that one is able to give to the other, as we found, and Rav Rivlin has an essay about this in his Sefer, as we find throughout the history that there are instances of that, that Rachel gives Leah the simanim, and Leah essentially through her tefillah gives Rachel one of her sons, in a reference to the idea that Dina was supposed to be a boy, but Leah realized that meant that out of the 12 sons that were destined to be, so that would be one less for Leah, for Rachel, so she davened that they should be switched. So we find instances of self-sacrifice throughout the generations that atones and corrects for any rivalry. I once thought you could be Masbir. The question is always asked by the Rishonim and others, how it is that Yaakov could marry two sisters, if that's a violation of the Torah. And we have a tradition that the Avos kept called Torah Kula. So how could it be that Yaakov married two sisters? Ramban asked this question, others asked this question. I thought it was possible to explain that even if the Avos kept the whole Torah, they were not obligated to. There was no tzivui. So how did they do it? Apparently they had a way to figure out what the values of the Torah were and to live up to those values even without a tzivui. So if that's the case, it presumably should change the rules a little bit, because we have a principle of Ein Darshin Taima Dekra, that it's not our job to interpret what the intent of a pasuk is, and certainly not to be makel based on that, to say that we are exempt from a Torah commandment because of how we perceive the reasoning. However, it would seem that if you don't have a tzivui in the first place, if you're only observing the mitzvah because of the time of the krah, because you have tapped into the reasoning, so then it makes sense you should be able to, so to speak, be dorish time of the krah before there was a krah. So perhaps the notion of not marrying two sisters is davka because of a concern of jealousy and rivalry. We know that if you learn Yevamos, the sisters who are married to the same person, two co-wives married to the same person, are called Saros because there's an inherent tension. So perhaps to put sisters in that position, that's maybe how we understood the time of the krah. So essentially, perhaps he was able to ascertain that with sisters such as Rachel and Leah, there was a sense of self-sacrifice to each other. So that this concern that we would have in general towards marrying sisters, perhaps Yaakov understood that it wasn't binding on him. So it's perhaps one way to understand it, but it's reflective of this idea that we have this history of rivalry and tension within the siblings, and we also have episodes of vitur, of giving to the other, that serve as a kapara. Jed?
So when it comes to Rachel Leah, though, it seems like there was a certain level of rivalry.
We do find various indications of that, yeah. So. But I think in the big things, they're able to be mavater to each other, and perhaps that's reflective of something more fundamental in their personalities. Suggestion. And there are Mefarshim who also suggest that the whole episode of this last week's parasha, mostly in Miketz, of what Yosef put the brothers through, that was about a tikkun for the mechira, that the behavior that they had engaged in when they sold Yosef, so Yosef wanted to give them an opportunity to act differently regarding Binyamin, and that their care for him would be a kapara, essentially, and would be a repair for what had gone wrong previously. So the kids, we have a history of rivalry and tension between the siblings, between the branches of the family, and ultimately that's going to have to be fixed if there's going to be a geula, if we're going to be able to move forward. So Yehuda and Yosef here represent actual descendants of Yehuda and Yosef, and they also represent various aspects of Jewish life. Perhaps Rabbi Avram Heschel Reisman in his Sefer, he talks about the Haftorah, suggests that Yehuda represents the state of Jews being in Shalom and Shalva, so to speak, in terms of their presence in the land. And Yosef, as the initial Yosef, represents in Mitzrayim, is symbolic of the Jews in Gullus when they are scattered and they are displaced. And whichever context it is, the point is we still need Achdus. We still need that unity, whether it's like Yehuda and we are B'shalva in our home, or it's like Yosef and we are exiled among the nations. Either way, Achdus is clutch. Achdus is absolutely crucial. And he suggests that that's also a message that Moshe was conveying, that with the whole Maisa with God and Menashe and God and Reuven, they got him Bnei Reuven and Chasdi Shevet Menashe, that Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven wanted to live on the other side of the river, and Moshe gives a nachala that essentially splits Menashe half and half. So why was that a part of the arrangement? So he explains that Moshe was afraid that if he let Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven live on that side of the river without the rest of Klal Yisrael, so essentially there would be a permanent disunity. They would create two different cultures and societies that have nothing to do with each other, and that was something he was concerned about. So therefore, by taking the Shevet Menashe, and having half and half, where you have already a family bond within that shevet that's going to keep the connections alive. So that creates a bridge between the two geographical areas, and that's going to hopefully preserve the internal unity. So in any event, this is clearly a theme that we find throughout this Haftorah, and there is more that's hidden within it as well, that as the Nevuah is explained in more detail, and we see this whole description of how the Jews are going to come together and all of their misdeeds are going to stop. So in Pasuk of Beis particularly, Avi tells us, V'yasisi osam l'goy echad ba'aretz b'hari Yisrael, there will be one nation, u'melech echad yeh l'chulam l'melech v'lo yeh od l'shnei goyim v'lo yechatsu od l'shnei mamlechos od. So it seems a little bit repetitive and overemphasized. There's going to be one leader, and they're not going to be divided into two kingdoms. And you have here the word od, od, od. So there is a suggestion in some of the Mefarshim that there is something between the lines here, particularly the Malbim and a few others, and that what's being conveyed here is that, yes, it's true, there will be a ultimate reuniting of the two kingdoms, and they'll be one, and they will have one leadership, but not necessarily always the same one. And then, in other words, what there is a reference here is to Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. And that's how the Malbim understands that the stick of Yehuda, that is Mashiach ben David, and the stick of Yosef, that is Mashiach ben Yosef. So Mashiach ben Yosef is a mysterious figure. What exactly that means, who exactly he is, what exactly he's there to do. And we find a few references to him in Chazal, particularly the Gemara in the end of Masechta Sukkah, for all of you last year who learned the whole Masechta. So you saw this Gemara in the Beis Amud Aleph, where the Gemara says that ultimately there's going to be a big hesped, going to be some big eulogy. And one possibility is that it's for the Mashiach ben Yosef, who's going to apparently be killed in war. And Mashiach ben David is going to see this, and he's going to survive, and he's going to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu that he wants life. And this notion of Mashiach ben Yosef, which is again a kind of a mysterious figure, so there are many who understand that Mashiach ben Yosef is going to be involved in the practical, physical components of the redemption, and that Mashiach ben David ultimately is going to rule over them spiritually. One of the most well-known advocates of this interpretation was Rav Kook. Rav Kook gave a very famous hesped for Herzl, where he described Herzl in this role of Mashiach ben Yosef, associated him with that role, essentially the notion of somebody who's going to bring together the practicalities of advancing the redemption. The Malbim understands here as well that Mashiach ben Yosef is going to fight the wars and gather all the Jews together, and that Mashiach ben David then will lead over them afterwards, and that that's the repeated usage of the word od, that each od that you find is referring to additional stages in Jewish history, the Mashiach ben Yosef stage and the Mashiach ben David stage. Rav Rivlin in his Sefer comments that this notion of spiritual and practical and various specialties within leadership, said that's also what you find, for example, with Moshe and Bezalel in creating the Mishkan, that Moshe had the spiritual direction, but Bezalel was the one who was able to give it a practical implementation, and that's why we need them working together. So there is a very interesting article about this topic in Bitoch Ohel. You know, we'd be quoting that eventually. So Rabbi Tzvi Sinensky has an article for this week's Parsha where he goes into the theme of Mashiach ben Yosef in greater detail. And he emphasizes its mystery, that it's not clear that Mashiach ben Yosef is necessarily a part of the future vision or not. He's not mentioned in Psukim, he's not mentioned in the Rambam. It's not 100% barer that he is a part of the story. And he also doesn't feel that this spiritual, practical chiluk is so absolute. And certainly if you look to David as the symbol of Mashiach ben David, so David we know was a warrior, certainly had that practical component. And also on the Mashiach ben Yosef front, there are those who understand that he will be fundamental in bringing about a spiritual tikkunim to the Jewish people, bringing about the spiritual improvement that's necessary to get to the redemption. So he doesn't think that it's so clear that the chiluk is that way, which prompts the question, so why do we need two redeemers? And ultimately what he develops in this article is that it's not so much about one focusing on one area and one focusing on the other area, but that the nature of the redemption is going to require each side being able to appreciate what the other contributes and not being focused on a rivalry or a jealousy of the other. So the ability for Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David to be able to come together in partnership and to each contribute whatever they contribute, that itself is a crucial stage in the Geula. And that's perhaps why we have this symbolism and why we have this notion connected with this vision, because reversing that rivalry, being able to take away that kinah, is a crucial part of what we are looking for. Now, the truth is, this is a theme which we find on many different levels. First of all, as we discussed a little bit last week, that the whole concept of the Mechira and the judgments that, or 2 weeks ago, the judgments that were made between the brothers, that itself was representative of Lashon Hara, in a sense, of judgments that were not really fair about each other, and that led to actions that were drastic. And whether it was just the brothers mistreating Yosef, or maybe it was going in both directions, as some understand, that Yosef also misjudged the brothers and was overly harsh in his assessment of them, one way or another, this was definitely a component. And we talked a few weeks ago about how the Mechira represents the beginning of decline, the beginning of the Galus, not only as far as its plot points, but as far as the whole aspect of not finding room for each other's positions and personalities and the unique role that we all play in creating Klal Yisrael. So the notion that the Gemara tells us that we continue to be in Galus because of Sinas Chinam is rooted in the pre-Galus experience of how the brothers treated each other. And therefore we need that to be fixed. We need the tikkun, whether we're talking of a broad scale of the kingdoms of Yehuda and Yisrael, or we're talking just on the individual level of how we treat each other as people. Now we need to be able to move beyond that idea of negative interpretations of each other and not seeing a place for where we all fit in together that has to be corrected, that has to be brought in line. And in essence, this is what the Geula needs in order for it to happen. We could also add that the idea of kinah, particularly the idea of jealousy is an olam hazeh emotion. Jealousy is something which represents seeing the world through a lens that is by its very nature short-sighted and not connected to an eternal truth. Remember Schechter once explaining that the Mishnah says that the Shlosha Dvarim Otsiyam Es Ha'adam and Ha'olam, there are three things that take people out of the world. Sounds like it means that it takes them out of Olam Haba. That's what it sounds like. Hakina, V'hataiva, V'hakavod. These three things, jealousy and lust and honor, take us out of the world. So you would think it means that it takes us out of Olam Haba. It gets us in trouble, these various midos, and causes us to sacrifice our future reward. But I believe, if I remember correctly, explained that really it takes you out of Olam Hazeh. That the point is, all of these pitfalls are based on a fundamental misunderstanding of the world. So, for example, when somebody chases after kavod, kavod is always illusory. It's always based on fake cheshbonos, on things that don't really make sense and don't have any enduring value. And therefore, when somebody is looking for that, so it's not just that it's going to take them down a dangerous path and hurt their Olam Haba, it takes them away from what's real in this world. And so too, taiva as well. Taiva is something which builds up in a person's mind that you think, oh, this must be so wonderful. And really, it's nothing. We explained the base of Levi, says the Gemara also there in Sukkah, says that a Kadosh Baruch Hu in the future is going to shech the Yetzirah. And the Yetzirah is going to look to the tzaddikim like a mountain. And they're going to say, wow, how are we ever able to conquer that mountain? It's so formidable. And the Rishayim are going to see the Yetzirah, and it's going to look to them like a hare. And they're going to say, how was it that we weren't able to conquer this hare, this little nothing? How is it that we weren't able to overcome that? So how is it that the same thing looks different to different groups of people? So the Beis Halevi explains that taiva, by its very nature, is something that people build up in their minds as more than it is. So the tzaddikim, who never gave in to the Yetzirah, so they're going to think, wow, it was such a big deal. It's amazing that we're ever able to conquer this. While the Rishayim, who gave into it, so they know that it's nothing. They know that it's just a hair, that it's not significant. The type also represents something which isn't real and takes you out of this world. So too, when it comes to kinah, kinah is jealousy. It represents the idea that somebody else has what I deserve. But if you recognize that God is running the world and He doesn't give other people what you deserve, and He doesn't give other people what you need. And what you need is what you have in front of you. So that notion of kinah is one that is particularly destructive, not just because it leads people to do things against each other, which it certainly does. That is the source of so much harm and conflict. But it's simply based on falsehood. And if we're going to seek a path towards ultimate redemption, we have to be able to beat that. We have to be able to overcome that there's any meaning, the thought that there's any meaning in the kinah that we feel, the taiva that we feel, the redifas hakavod that we feel. All of these are taking us out of what life is really about. And if we're looking for a future of ultimate truth, then we have to be able to rise above that and to overcome that. So this notion of being able to work together and to respect the place that everyone has within Klal Yisrael, within the redemption of the world, that's necessary for the redemption to be able to happen. And that's a very strong message of what the Haftarah is telling us. And together with that, Achdus is important for additional reasons as well, because if we are going to convey God's message to the world, so we can only do that if we're all together and conveying the message. If there are five different possible versions of what Klal Yisrael is. So then we don't have a unified message. So we have a very delicate balance in terms of how we navigate Achdus considerations often, because our whole goal is to create Kiddush Hashem in the world, is to create a unified message. So we have to try to preserve both parts of the equation, that we're unified, but that the message is the message. So we have to know when exactly to insist on boundaries in order to preserve the message. But to the extent that we can preserve unity, that's crucial so that the message is able to get across. So that is one of the reasons why Achdus is so important. And perhaps this is also what's conveyed by the closing psukim of the Haftorah. Again, I think this Haftorah is really pretty explicit. Even though it deals in imagery, but the imagery is quite clear and paints a picture that's very easy to understand. So if you look at, let's say, the last three psukim of the Haftorah, it really makes the message very distinct. V'charati lehem bris shalom, bris olam yeh osam, v'nasatim b'hir beis yeh osam, v'nasati es mikdashi b'socham le'olam. So God says, I'll make a bris of shalom with them. It'll be a permanent bris. I will establish them and multiply them, and my mikdash will be with them forever. V'haya mishkani alayim, v'yisi lehem le'elokim, v'heim yolam. So my shechina will be with them. I will be their God, and they will be my people. V'yadu hagayim, and the nations of the world will know. Ki ani Hashem mekadesh Yisrael, b'yos mikdashi b'socham le'olam. That this is my message, that I sanctify the Jewish people, and my mikdash shall be among them forever. So it's really a pretty clear, pretty explicit message of what exactly we're going for a permanent Kiddush Hashem, and a Kiddush Hashem that is built on the Jews being able to preserve this ability to be ba'achdus and to work together and to convey the message to the whole world. And particularly we have a tainus coming up. It's an opportunity to reflect on that. This is one of the tanaisim that's a part of the whole structure of how we remember the Golus and how we aspire towards the Geula. Be'ez Hashem, I'll try to fill in a little bit more about that on Motzai Shabbos, where you will all be. So I won't necessarily spend too much more time talking about that now, but I will see you all at Mlav Malka. I'll have, God willing, a little bit more to say about that theme and how the tainus, should there be one on Tuesday, is an opportunity to focus us on these values as well. So I'll just add for a few more minutes that one of the major examples of vitor, of giving towards the other, perhaps appears in the beginning of the parasha, just to add a little bit to this theme, that the Torah describes that Yosef decides to reveal himself to the brothers, and he sends away his bodyguards. He sends away all of the Mitzrim who are around, so he can be alone with the brothers. And apparently he did this, as the Midrashim explain, because he didn't want to embarrass the brothers. This was going to be quite an awkward moment where they find out that he's the one who they sold into slavery all those years ago, and now he's in charge. This is going to be quite a powerful emotional moment, and it's going to be very awkward for them. So he saved them from the embarrassment by sending away the bodyguards. And in the Medrash there is a debate, there's a machlokas, whether this was right or not. Is this the right thing to do? Because Yosef really put his life at risk. Because by sending away the bodyguards, so there was the possibility that the brothers would say, wow, this is awkward, but at least no one's here, so we can kill him and escape, and no one will have to know. So Yosef essentially, it seems, put his life at risk in order to allow this confrontation to happen without any witnesses. So the Medrash has two opinions whether this was right or not. So this is evocative of what was also conveyed in Parshas Vayeshev a few weeks ago, where Tamar makes the same kind of calculation that she declines to identify Yehuda as the father of her children because she wasn't willing to embarrass him, even though it put her life at risk because she was about to be executed. And the Gemara in Maseches Bava Metzia and a few other places, it comes up a number of times in Shas, the Gemara says that you see from here that it seems like it's appropriate to risk your life in order to prevent embarrassment to other people. Now, it's a fascinating concept. I would emphasize, do not try this at home, that you should not actually put your life at risk in these circumstances, but it's not such a pashut davar in the discussions that you find in the Rishonim and the Achronim, that the Gemara seems to imply that it's Yeharik Val Yavor, that it's something that you should risk your life for. Again, do not try this at home. But the Rishonim did discuss the possibility, and it seems like some indeed took that side, that this is something which is included as Abizrayu Deshvichas Damim, that the Gemara compares embarrassing people to killing them, and therefore it's like murder. And if it's like murder, so what do we mean when we say that? Do we mean it's really like murder, or is this just a melitza that we're saying this is something which is really very serious and you should take great steps to avoid? So this was a discussion in Poskim. You could find a whole debate about whether it is indeed Yeharik Val Yavor, as it sounds like from these sources. And coming from there, other discussions, for example, why don't we say that we should be Mechal Shabbos in order to prevent somebody from being embarrassed? Or should we say that a Kohen who embarrasses people shouldn't be allowed to Duchen, just like a Kohen who kills people is not allowed to Duchen? And should we say that this is treated as one of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nei Noach, because since Ritzicha is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs, so maybe also embarrassing people should be included as a subset of that? So there are many fascinating discussions about just how far one would go with this comparison. But I think the bottom line is that usually those aren't the situations that we're confronting. It's usually not a question of having to risk your life in order to avoid embarrassing someone. So being that the scenarios that we have, the stakes are generally lower, so it should just be a Musar Haskel for us that to know that this is such a serious avera that there's at least a discussion that it might be Yeharik Val Yavor and Docha Shabbos and the like, has a very powerful statement to make about just how serious this is. And it's a part of the whole idea that if you really felt a connection with someone else, if you really were able to identify with their emotions and their tzar, so you wouldn't be too quick to embarrass them, to cause any humiliation. And that should be a very powerful Musar Haskel for us, that we should be able to appreciate that the scenarios that we're dealing with, which are generally more mundane, everyday scenarios, to know that there's at least a theoretical discussion that it could be a Yeharik Val Yavor or a Docha Shabbos. So since that's generally not the cheshbon that we're forced to make, so we should at least appreciate just how serious a consideration it is. And we know that the Gemara tells us that the Churban began with an episode of Halbanus Pnei Chaver V'Rabim and the whole story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa at the party, and how an individual who was publicly embarrassed, who was held up to ridicule in front of people, was so hurt by this and was willing to sell out his people and was willing to go to such extremes and to begin the series of events, put them in motion, that led to the Churban. So it's a very powerful statement, and the Gemara talks about just how much is connected to Onas Dvarim, to one who feels humiliated, to one who feels that they have been embarrassed. They're able to, unfortunately, do a lot of damage, and they're even given assistance in doing that damage, apparently. And again, all of this connects to our themes of what's necessary for redemption. How do we bring the Geula back? So being able to appreciate the pitfalls of Sinas Chinam, of Lashon Hara, and Halapanos Panei Chaver Barabim, and of the kina that often drives that. I think we've mentioned in the past that the notion of Lashon Hara very often is motivated by kina, essentially. We spoke earlier in the year in the context of Bava Kamma about the hana that the nachash gets or doesn't get. We spoke about that. So the whole machlokas, whether there's any hana in Lashon Hara, the Chafetz Chaim said there's no hana, and the Chazon Ish said that shows that he never tasted Lashon Hara if he thinks there's no hana. And among the motives for Lashon Hara that people are driven by is the concern of miskabe b'kol chavero, that they feel like they can only get honor through knocking somebody else down. And like we said a few minutes ago, in terms of the illusion of kavod, that's a major reflection of that illusion, that if you think that the only way you're going to have stature in this world is to knock down somebody else, that is inherently fake. It means that the only credit you can give to yourself is that you're better than the next guy. So that's not worth anything. It means there's no real value. And it's perhaps instructive that when we find references to Miskabe B'Kon Chavero and the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. So the Yerushalmi and the Rambam are very harsh. They say Miskabe B'Kon Chavero Ein Lo Chelek La'olam Haba. And the Gemara and the Bavli has it a little softer, that the Miskabe B'Kon Chavero is cited as something to avoid if you want a long life. It's a siman of bracha for somebody who did live a long life was that he was never Miskabe B'Kon Chavero. So one could understand those references, not just that it's a big avera, and if you do this, you have no olam haba, and if you don't do this, you have a long life. But if you are miskabe b'klon chavero, then nothing you have is real. You don't have any real accomplishments. The only thing that is lifting you up is the fact that the guy next to you is knocked down. So then there's no olam haba, there's no long life to be rewarded, because there's nothing that was accomplished. And it's crucial that when we seek to contribute to this world, that we do so through actually contributing and accomplishing, and not trying to gain stature through knocking the other one down. So essentially, this is, as much as anything else, the key to the Geula. The key to the Geula is we have to really do good things. And the good things have to be defined as really good things, and not just look good because the other guy looks bad. So until we can overcome the kina, and we can overcome the need to have what the other one has, and to be miskabe b'kon chavero, to push him off, like the story of Yisrael Salanter, where he saw two boys fighting about which one was taller. And one boy eventually pushed the other one to the ground and said, "There, now you see I'm certainly taller." And Yisrael said to him, "Why'd you have to do that? You could have just stood on a box and you'd be taller." So that's how we're meant to accomplish things in this world. We have to actually lift ourselves up and not knock the other guy down. And that's the whole difference between fake accomplishments and real accomplishments. And if we're looking to a world of truth, that's what we need to focus on. So it's very much the message of the Haftarah. It's a theme that comes out throughout the Parsha. And I think maybe also, I don't know if you mentioned it here, I mentioned on Shabbos a few weeks ago, that there is a idea, the Talmud Yerushalmi says, that Pidgin HaBen is a kapara for Mechiras Yosef. So the Meshech Chachmei asks, how does that make sense? In the Pidgin HaBen, so a descendant of Levi who participated in the Mechira, he gets paid theoretically by a descendant of Yosef who was the victim of the Mechira. So how does that make sense as a kapara for the Mechira? And I think perhaps you could say that it's not about who pays who. It's not about the question of, oh, the one losing money or the one gaining money. It's about what's displayed by Pidgin HaBen. And here it's essentially the opposite of the Mechira, that in the events surrounding Mechiras Yosef, so someone said he aspires to leadership and to great things, and the people who hear that say, okay, let's get rid of this guy, let's throw him somewhere else so we don't have to deal with him. And the message of Pinyin Aven is that somebody is destined for Kedusha, and we show how much we value that and how much we want to pay for that and to continue to have that person in our midst. It's essentially the opposite message of the Mechira, and that's really the kind of attitude that needs to be brought if we are going to see the Geula. So as the Mechira is the paradigmatic Avera ben Adam Machavero, the tikkunim that we bring towards that event and towards all of the smaller versions of that in our own lives is crucial as we look to bring about a Geula, and particularly in the coming week, if there is a fast to be observed, that's a theme that should very much be on our minds. Okay, so I will wish you a wonderful Shabbos. I look forward to seeing all of you right after Shabbos here at the Lava Malka, and we will have a wonderful time together. Okay.